Greetings and welcome to On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 333, coming at you from Dripstone Beach here, one of the coastal suburbs of Darwin, Northern Territory. It's the 22nd or 23rd of August, 2020. It's really cool to be up here in the top end. I'm coming into my second week after five beautiful months in Tasmania, where for the last month I saw ice just about every morning. And here I see the sun come up about 7:30, and it's about 23 degrees. Just absolutely beautiful and amazingly cool. And I'm doing a lot of bicycling, maybe between 15 and 30 kilometers every day. I'm at a park next to the ocean, and there's some indigenous youth kind of squawking and making noise. And I'm being treated to one of the most beautiful displays of avian acrobatics that I've ever seen. I was here a couple of days ago at this exact table, and I saw these birds kind of swooping down and floating, and they weren't hunting, and they weren't doing anything really fast, but they were just kind of lofting and swooping down low and kind of circling around and pirouetting. And there's a dozen or two of them, and I thought they were small eagles, but they're actually a bird called a Brahminy kite. They're kind of like a medium-sized brown raptor. They're so graceful when they play, but then I remember the expression kiting around, and I think that's when, like, if a young girl kind of like is quite promiscuous, she kites around. And so I don't know that promiscuity has anything to do with the flights of these birds, but it was just so entrancing yesterday to watch them for like an hour. They would swoop down about a meter from the ground, and they were just only just a few meters from me. They would, a group of them would come, and then they'd go away, and then they'd come back. And there's quite a few around today, but they're not right here where I am. This show is entitled The Karma of COVID and Other Unnatural Disasters. I've sort of dealt with the whole pandemic coronavirus thing quite a lot back in the early weeks and months of when it was happening, and sort of tried to keep abreast of it all, but didn't really dwell on it very much because it just seemed to be counterproductive for a really long time. People were just obsessed with it and focusing on all kinds of different aspects and dimensions that are rabbit holes, but not really providing any immediate guidance or information that was really of value. So what I'm trying to do, as I do with a lot of my investigative research with On the Brink, is to frame it all into a larger perspective to try to make sense out of what's going on and why. Not so much who or what, but why it might be going on. And one of the things I keep bringing up with people is that when you pull back and look at this as a process that's been going on since like February or March, it's not an isolated incident. If you want to look at it in terms of what it's being made out to be, in terms of the perception management apparatus, as a biomedical pandemic or epidemic or a biomedical emergency or something like that, you know, if you want to believe that that's what it is, it's nothing new. I mean, we've had plagues and outbreaks of diseases and all different kind of stuff. I mean, at least this is the models that we've adopted and the maps that we've been following based, you know, to map out different kind of contagions and things, you know, going back as far as we know into history. Plagues that have killed people in Europe, like the Black Plague, the Red Death, and bubonic plague, and all kind of things like polio and malaria, and just the whole slew of all these diseases and stuff. The Spanish flu in the early decades of the 20th century. So, in the context of all these, this is just a little blip. It's really nothing. But you have to look at it in the context of, even if that really is what it is, it's still being foisted on us through the greatest weapon system in use, mass media, especially television and the internet and radio, the combined socio-psychological effects of these technologies that have been in use for, well, close to 100 years now. We've all been progressively indoctrinated by techniques pioneered by Edward Bernays, public relations and the manufacture of consent and that kind of thing. So the difference between COVID-19 and the measles or the flu is that COVID-19 is getting a massive amount of PR. It's got the best PR agents in the world working for it to give it the maximum clout, the maximum visibility, the maximum impact. But this is all perception management. It has little or nothing to do with the reality. And everything I'm saying, this is assuming that you believe the official narrative, that it's an autonomous pathogen that's extremely dangerous. But when you look into it, a very, 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 very large number of highly credible researchers and medical professionals, doctors themselves, at the front line at Ground Zero, have come out with different levels of evaluation, assessment, and analysis of this whole thing, and pointed out the vast number of contradictions and inconsistencies and scientific inaccuracies in the official story, relating all the way from what viruses actually are or aren't, to what vaccines are or aren't, to what this thing actually is and what it do or doesn't do, and all this stuff. And this is just looking at it biomedically. So there's a lot of bullshit out there. And to reiterate, again, because it's been many weeks since I've really even talked about this, I personally have never even taken the thing seriously. I wouldn't be afraid to be in a room with a bunch of people that had been tested positive for it a dozen times and actually showed symptoms of it, whatever that might be, respiratory breathing, or maybe they're hyperventilating and quaking or sweating, or, I mean, you know, who knows, whatever it is. It's just like somebody that's sick. I've got a very strong, powerful immune system and am in immensely robust health. And so when you're healthy, you're not going to get that kind of thing. It might get you in a moment of weakness, you know, if you get, like, for example, chilled down and wet, or and when you're under stress or really tired from lack of rest, or if you've been compromised, you know, for a certain amount of time, or specifically, like with any sort of disease or illness, people are more affected that are more vulnerable due to not being that healthy because of it. And it's not age per se that makes anybody vulnerable to anything. It's the degeneration or the failure of different kinds of systems of our body and our functioning that have degenerated over time, haven't been maintained properly. So age has nothing to do with it. It's the condition you're in. So people that already have existing health conditions, all that kind of stuff, these are the people that have been dying from this thing. And so, sure, but for every point that intelligent researchers have tried to make, the bullshit counterspin artists propaganda machine tries to come out and counter it with even more bullshit. And you've got the ridiculous fact-checking thing, like on Facebook. Oh my God, who can even believe all this shit? So you've got it, like with anything, you can't even just start out with this and go like, oh, I'm going to become an expert in biomedical virology or epidemiology of diseases or something like that. It's not something you can just pick up the main points from overnight, because you have to kind of like be working on developing your knowledge base and your perspective from a variety of sources, personal and public and all different kind of stuff. And what places me in a vantage point with all this is that I've been doing this kind of thing for decades. Not only my official education in science was just the beginning of my educational process, and it's continued to this day. And like I was telling my friend the other day, I question everything, but I'll listen to anyone. I listen to everyone, to what they have to say with an open mind and heart, and try, because everybody might have their own little piece of the puzzle to contribute. And I might gently try to suggest to people that they might be barking up the wrong tree, or that they might be, you know, affected by a certain kind of disinformation or scientific inaccuracy. But, and there's no shortage of that. But the important thing is to have a flexible process rather than a fixed certainty that your perspective on anything. But the point I keep making about all this is that the pattern that's emerging, and I've been noticing it for a really long time, you could see a pattern, even if I wasn't familiar with the strategic blueprint of Zbigniew Brzezinski from his book Between Two Ages, America and the Technotronic Era, from 1972 or 1973. In that book, he lays out a blueprint for imperial mobilization, for the U.S. or whatever you want to call it, to sort of take over the whole world via full-spectrum dominance. But this, it's military parlance, but it's about seizing control of every aspect of human life on this planet. And not just seizing control in the traditional military way. There's this beautiful yellow bird up here singing in my tree. Even if I weren't familiar with the strategic doctrine of Zbigniew Brzezinski, I would have noticed patterns over the past few years in terms of ideologies or fear memes being foisted on the public via mass media. And there's four basic things that have been going on, starting back in like the 1970s and into the 80s. And it's really never gone away, but the whole thing of aliens, UFOs, alien beings, all the stuff on the X-Files and Steven Spielberg and all the D-Day, Independence Day, and all these movies and stuff like that. That was the biggest thing for a while, all the threat of the alien invasion, UFOs. And that was just huge. It was a huge thing for the longest time. And then that gradually started becoming supplanted by Islamic terrorists as the new fear bogey. This was kind of a gradual transition. But then we had 9/11 and Osama bin Laden and all this stuff. And so then it was and then ISIS and Al-Qaeda and all this stuff. And all this was like the dominant fear meme for the longest time. But then that started gradually becoming supplanted by the whole thing with global warming. But then that started morphing into what became climate change. And so up until even back in January or February of this year, we had, that was the dominant fear thing, the whole thing of climate change. And we had Greta Thunberg, she was like the dominant, she was bigger than Trump in terms of a media personality, and she was interviewing David Attenborough and all this stuff. And then all of a sudden, all this has been completely eclipsed by coronavirus. And so, if you can see what I'm saying, all of these things are being presented and foisted and manipulated and orchestrated mainly as media artifacts in precisely the same way. And if you can't see that, you're pretty blind. But what these are, this is a textbook blueprint that the orchestrators are following. It's what Brzezinski talked about in the Technotronic Era. He says that persisting social crisis is one of the instruments or modi operandi that the unrestrained powers that be can use as a way to transform American and world society into a more highly controlled society. And controlled, I guess, in the way of being obedient sheeple, of controlled in the way of restrained from their own freedom to do this and that. And they could be framing it in the perspective of the Club of Rome, which is ties in heavily with this. I was just reading an article today about how the Club of Rome and the Trilateral Commission, which was founded by Brzezinski on behalf of the Rockefellers, and the Club of Rome was born in Rockefeller's place in Italy, in both in 1973. So the Club of Rome was kind of framing it from the perspective that there are these environmentally conscious overlords who, in the best interest of humanity and the preservation of life on Earth, they want to control and restrain humanity, who is obviously its own worst enemy, in ways that will be sustainable. But this is the kind of thing, it sounds good on paper, but when you look at it, it's like, it's nothing like that at all. These people are bankers. Their primary interest in all this is financial, or the control of resources, or a new kind of reality beyond all that, where they're the ones, this small elite is the ones at the top of the heap in control of everything. And then the remaining people that haven't been depopulated out of existence will be their, kind of like their pets, or their domestic animals that might serve some kind of laborial function or something like that. Or maybe we'll just be allowed to exist like some animals in the zoo. We can, you know, have our areas that we can go and roam around in, and maybe do some shopping, maybe play some golf or something like that, to keep alive the old traditions of what people have used their most precious time to do. But persistent social crisis, and then you can add in persistent social, ecological, economic crisis, which is what all of these different kind of things tie in together. But the whole emphasis is that this COVID thing is a completely unnatural disaster. It's not a naturally occurring microbe just infecting some people and making people sick. If any of that even is true, that it's an autonomous pathogen different from the flu or the cold or anything like that, it still really doesn't matter, because that's not what this whole thing is about. It's about social engineering and the seizure of this. It's a smokescreen. They're using this as an excuse for complete totalitarian scientific dictatorship, police state, authoritarianism, and not across the board, but they're trying different sort of levels of it in different places. Like New Zealand has never really been free of it ever since March, and then like you've got the state of Victoria in Australia that's, according to one guy, it's worse than anything he saw in Argentina back in the 1970s. Under, you know, there's police out with guns on the street. So anyway, this is clearly what's going on, and there's still a lot of people that believe that all these lockdowns and stuff are in their best interest, that it's protecting them from getting infected, and that people running around doing international travel and not wearing a mask are, how dare them put other people's lives at risk by the possibility of transmitting this evil bogey that might, you know, you, according to the official story, you can have it and be transmitting it, but show no signs of it yourself. But how absurd is that? If that's true, anybody could have anything, anywhere, all the time, and be giving it to other people. And, I mean, if you're going to go that far, you may as well say, well, we could all be having different kind of diseases and syndromes and stuff that we just don't know about, because if it doesn't make you sick, how would you know you've got it? And so, and what does it mean to be infected by something? We assume that being infected means that you've got disease. I mean, you know, that something's going wrong that you can know about. But if you're, what if you're infected with something that is masked or cloaked or in disguise, and maybe it's doing stuff that you have no idea about? Maybe it's not hurting you, but it's doing other things. Maybe it just needs a place to live. Maybe it's plotting your future. Maybe it's affecting you at the genetic level. I mean, there could be organisms or substances or things in nature or from off-world that we don't even know about that could actually do stuff like this. And this has probably been written about in a lot of science fiction that I don't know about. You know, so the reality is there's a lot we don't know. But what we're being told with all this, most of it is not even remotely true. It couldn't possibly be. And the main thing you can do is just be happy and healthy, and don't be afraid. And don't cower in fear, and just try to lead a normal, healthy life within the, you know, you don't want to put yourself at risk from the bureaucratic stuff. That's the main problem. But if we look at, you know, what I call all this stuff, well, there's the concept called false flag terrorism. That's when real violence is committed, like something's blown up or people are killed or a virus is spread or something like that. But then using the media, it's all hyped up and amplified way out of proportion. But the main thing, the false flag comes in, is when they try to blame somebody that didn't do it, whether it's a disease vector, real or perceived, or a group of people or an organization or a country, a culture, or something like that. So the false flag is like framing in the organized crime sense. It's you frame somebody by committing a crime and then trying your best to make it look like that they did it when actually you did it. So that's really what all this stuff is. And psychological warfare involves primarily small amounts of real violence and real destruction and damage, but the psychological part is that it is amplified through the use of media. Because if you just think about it, if you go and blow up a bridge or kill a few people and then try to scare people with that, the people that don't know about it aren't going to be affected. You know, so if you just do one thing and then share it with everybody, it can have the maximum effect. And then you add in that, well, you can give the impression that this happened, meaning that it can be staged. And a lot of the terrorism that we see on the news, and a lot of the news in general, especially at the international level, is exactly this. It's fabricated by public relations firms. And so this is old school. This is given. I mean, this has been going on for many, many decades. But the emphasis here is on the centrality of media as a weapon. Because if you think about it, where do you get your daily information from? And how much of it do you go and actually dig for? Do some independent research, talk to some leading authorities in a field, read some books, read some scientific articles from a variety of sources to try to ask the same question to a number of different people or organizations or perspectives and see how the answers line up. And if you get a different answer from every person or group, the chances are that it's, you know, it's possible that each of them may have some truth, or it might equally be possible that none of them have any truth. You know, but if you've been working on stuff for decades and certain researchers or minds keep coming up as highly respected, and then you start getting in touch with them or following their work, reading their books, and you can sort of flesh out high resolution pictures on a lot of stuff. And I've been doing this in a number of disciplines. And another thing that's starting to crop up right now. Just in the past week or two, we've got dozens of wildfires that have destroyed over 700,000 acres in northern and central California. All apparently started by anomalous lightning strikes. And so this is just extraordinarily fishy. It's just like what happened in Australia back in December or November, what happened in California the past couple of years. It's textbook geophysical warfare unfolding once again. And I'm really afraid for what the situation is going to unfold into here in Australia over the coming weeks and months. I think it was in August of last year when the fires in Queensland started, very early in the season. And then there was a little lull, and then some fires started up in the northern recesses of the Blue Mountains just around the same time, or just before my friend Craig and I made our journeys to Mount Yango, the very sacred Uluru of the East Coast people in the Hunter Valley hinterland, inland from the Central Coast in New South Wales. So that was extraordinarily powerful, but it looks like this whole thing is getting ready to happen again. But this time it's going to be happening in a society that's already under the knife of the COVID-19 scenario. And so when you look at all this stuff, it's like humanity is literally waging war on itself. And this is nothing new, but it's just becoming more and more concentrated and intensified. The main topic of the show is to look at why all this is happening. And I use the word karma in the title of the show, the karma of COVID and other unnatural disasters. And the basic idea of karma is a Hindu concept. It's kind of like, it's quite complex, and they consider it to be a law, not just a principle, but a law that works very precisely and very specifically. So I don't pretend to be an authority or expert on that or anything, but the basic gist of karma is that what comes around goes around. You know, that what you individually and as groups, as a society, as a culture, as a species, what we do, what we put out to the universe, comes back to us. It rebounds. It cycles around. It's like the energy and intense and actions that you put out are reflected back to you in the same way, like as an echo, like if you're in a big cavern or an acoustic space, your echo. Karma is kind of like the echo coming back at you of what you do. And that kind of makes a sense. It's kind of like a multi-dimensional echo. And so if you put out harmonious good actions and deeds, then that's what'll be coming back to you, because it's just the same thing that you did coming back. And the same thing happens when you put out a lot of destructive vibrations and actions. Those vibrations and actions and implications of that come back to you. So this is very oversimplified, but I think there's a lot of truth to it. And so as I see it, we've been living in violation of the real way that we were meant to live as human beings on Mother Earth. We've been, as a whole, what we call civilization has been built upon and evolved or progressed in directions totally inimical or antithetical to what life is really all about, and in direct violation of warnings and admonitions given to us by indigenous people from all over who knew that we were never supposed to do the kind of things that civilization is built on and that we take for granted as part of our comfort and convenience and our empowerment as privileged beings in Western society. And I talk about the Hopi Native Americans a lot because their concept of Koyaanisqatsi, that's Koyaanisqatsi, it means life out of balance or crazy life, a way of life calling for another way of living, makes a lot of sense. And I was taught about this by Hopi elder Thomas Banyakya when we were on the Hopi reservation in April of 1986. And it was extremely powerful because at the same time we were learning about the global nuclear scenario and the primary warning that had been given by the Hopi elders thousands of years before that said, if we dig precious things from the land, we will invite disaster. We were never meant to mine out anything out of the earth, not even rock, not diamonds, not coal, not gold, not silver, not tin, not hydrocarbons, not uranium. We were never meant to dig this stuff. We were never meant to harm the body of Mother Earth. And I think that if we used very, very small amounts of things and in a sacred way, like for example, the way that the indigenous Australians use this mineral called ochre, they use it for color, for like dyeing fabrics and for body painting and stuff like that. But they were very, very, very respectful to the place where they got it and how much they took and what they did with it. It was a sacred process. They never maliciously dug out a whole bunch of it so that they could store it up or transport it or sell it. I mean, they didn't even have commerce. Indigenous people all over the world didn't have systems of finance. They had extraordinarily complex and advanced spiritual and sociological systems having to do with the ways of living and marriage and relationships and all different things like that, but they saw no need for a centrally controlled financial apparatus that's really just a form of slavery. But to have a sense of sacred, like, you know, I think with almost everything that Homo sapiens has done, if we were able to do just a tiny little bit of it that helped us fulfill a need, we might not have been so destructive and wrought such vast negative karma on ourselves. But we've never known when to say enough is enough, and I call it the acybernetic syndrome. What Jonas Salk talks about is the loss of the ability of self-regulation. So we can't, as a whole, we can't go like, well, look, I've got enough, I'm going to stop now. No. In a system that's dominated by the Moloch of the whole concept of money and financial gain, there's no limit. There's no limit to how much of everything people think that they want and need. But it's all just complete hallucination and an abstraction, like in terms of like how much money there is. I mean, it doesn't even exist. It's just however many zeros can be printed out or stored in a computer or other people made to believe exists. That's all it is. It's not even really a measure of anything. I mean, you know, at the day-to-day level, you know, because it has nothing to do with, like, we've used the metaphor of fuel. My friend Janos, who's commissioned me to do a painting, a really cool person, he said, like, well, I was talking about how money doesn't really mean that much to me. Because, well, think of it as fuel, you know, and in a sense, it is. It's fuel that helps you obtain what you need that you can get from other people. Like, for example, if you need to buy some food or a plane ticket or some art supplies or something like that, it's fuel in that sense, but it's not fuel. It's only social fuel. It's not fuel in the sense that you can't put the money in your car or in your stomach or into your paint tray. I mean, you can, but it's not going to do anything. So it's all it is, it's primarily psychological, because even if you've got a mountain of gold sitting in front of you, what possible good is it if you're alone? I mean, you can sit there and worship it, or you can get its vibe and get a buzz, and you can contemplate how you might rule the world with it and all this stuff, but what are you going to do? I mean, you can't use it for anything. The Egyptians use it for jewelry, but it's too soft to use as a metal. It's a good conductor of electricity. Gold could be very useful if you want to get other people to do stuff for you, like sell you their sailboat or a piece of property or plane ticket to Mars or something like that, but it has no intrinsic use value. It's a psychological thing. But for whatever reason that we've wanted to mine out all the gold, gold and silver are two of the more abstract ones that we've been obsessed with, but ones that they don't really want. The damage from them is in the mining and refining and extraction processes and the side effects of that, like all the chemicals and stuff that are generated from processing the gold, and the damage from the mines and the pollution of the water and the rape of the land and the socioeconomic terror inflicted on people who happen to be living on top of gold or that have used it in their society. Like, for example, the people of South America that used massive amounts of gold to decorate their temples and buildings and stuff like that. The Spanish just went crazy and murdered them all, stole all their gold. And all the different places where the local indigenous people have been disrupted so that mining companies can get at their gold, like Bougainville in Papua New Guinea, sits atop what I believe to be is the largest single gold ore body on the whole planet. But gold is just one of the ones that a lot of people have killed each other over. But there's ones with far greater ecological catastrophic consequences, like the whole hydrocarbon scenario, the whole scenario with uranium, the global nuclear scenario made possible because of that. And the mining industry, coal here in Australia. You know, so if each of these things that we've mined out is a horror story in itself, but if you look at the sum total of that and the damage that we've wrought and continue to wreak on Mother Earth herself, as well as all of our fellow life forms, because of our violation of this one admonition, if we dig precious things from the land, we will invite disaster. We're living in that disaster right now, and it's only getting worse. Anybody that sees things getting better, I think, are not looking very close, especially if you look at, I mean, it's really hard for us to be aware of ecological dangers because most people's reality doesn't really extend that far past the distance from their smartphone to their face, you know, and to the majority of people, whatever's outside that radius just doesn't hardly really even matter, unless it's maybe some friends of theirs or something like that. So if you've got to go to some work to try to expand your big picture, your Weltanschauung of understanding what it is that's going on in the world and what the implications of that are, and the perspective that to me actually matters the most, far more than what mankind is doing to mankind, is what mankind is doing to all the other species of life on this planet. But the whole, to me, the whole COVID-19 thing, it's just the latest example of humanity's warfare on itself. And it's the karma behind that is because we keep carrying our ecological damage to the next level, minute by minute, with every new technological advance, with every new weapon system, with every new industrial construction site, with every new military base, with every new rocket launch and mission to Mars. And the concept of, for example, Duncan Steele wanting to infect Mars with genetically modified organisms, what I'm calling Operation Frankenseed, stuff like that. I mean, this is like horrific beyond comprehension. And if you want to talk about stuff that we could do that could bring down even more bad karma on us, when we're talking about escaping the boundaries of our destruction and desecration limited to Mother Earth, when we're trying to expand this out into orbital space, into orbiting around the Earth and going to the moon, contaminating the moon with Israeli tardigrades, and launching probes going to Mars, disseminating genetically modified organisms and taking people to Mars. I don't think we're ever going to make it, for many reasons, and I really hope we don't. But it's literally like spreading the infection throughout the solar system. And Loren Isley wrote a brilliant essay called The World Eaters, where he likens humanity to the cellular slime mold that, after it's devoured its local vicinity, it forms a fruiting body and it sends out all these spores to go and start the process somewhere else. And so that's very much like what that Israeli vehicle that crashed on the moon and spilled all these tardigrades. It had all this sort of like, I mean, who knows what was in there, but it was like information, genetic information and all different kind of stuff. It was like a viral spore capsule sent to the moon, and maybe it was designed to crash on purpose. So who do we think we are? What and what are we? You know, and we can't really know ourselves, because when we look at ourselves through the lens of civilized megalomania, we think we're God's gift to humanity. But I think if we were able to perceive ourselves through the perceptual mechanisms of other species of life, they probably still love us, but they're mystified by our destructive behavior, and a lot of them have learned the hard way that we aren't to be trusted and that we're to be avoided at all costs. So no other species has actively tried to take us out, except maybe at the individual level. But I think that that's going to happen, but from a much larger perspective and in a much different kind of way. That's not really the topic of the show. It's about karma. And so I think that we're receiving our karmic payback, but this is only the beginning. And especially in Australia, where the beautiful indigenous people here have suffered and continue to suffer so enormously from the invasion of the Europeans in the 1700s. I don't see how any white man can actually achieve spiritual stability and harmonious existence anywhere in this country unless their life is fully dedicated to understanding and nurturing and protecting and healing the sacred hoop with the First Nations people here. And that's been the dominant thing that I've tried to do, and that's central to my life the whole more than 20 years that I've been traveling here. It's the purpose of my healing journey around Australia now. my connection with the indigenous people, my art, trying to express maps of the new dreaming that express our cosmic connection with water-based life, and the magic of the creativity of the Dreamtime ancestors, of whom we are the modern day incarnations of them. So we could go a step further and look at possible driving mechanisms behind what the Hindus call the yugas, these kind of seasons of the galactic year. And they say that we're in the Kali Yuga now, which is the shortest, but it's the darkest season. It's like the winter of the galactic cycle. It's the time in which we are essentially separated from our true spiritual essence, and we've sunk down, our vibration has become so low that we think that material reality is primary and that it's all that exists, and the spirit is just kind of like an epiphenomenon or a superfluous side effect, whereas I think the actual reality is exactly the opposite, that consciousness is the primary reality, and that the material world is kind of like a creation of consciousness in a way. But I mean, in a way, when you think about it, it actually is, because we're creating our perceptions of the world, science will say, with our own neurobiology. But it's a very interesting and sacred process, and it's like I was telling my friend, it might just be a hologram, but it's a very believable one. So I think to me, it's just a beautiful gift that we exist, that we have beautiful bodies, the ultimate technology, and the beauty of Mother Earth, and the beautiful landscapes, and all our fellow plants and animals and rocks and the star nations and everybody. It's the Garden of Eden. And you can still see and perceive that. Like, I'm kind of in it right here now. The beautiful yellow little bird and the Brahmini kites and the beautiful she-oaks and Mother Ocean. Some children laughing. And yet, down in Melbourne, a couple of thousand kilometers from here, people are under a vicious, totalitarian police state lockdown, and yet, this is the same country. So, karma inflicts itself in different ways, and I've talked about the concept of teleology, which is very interesting. It gives a purposiveness to otherwise random events. Like, for example, if the Earth was impacted by a comet that took out civilization as we know it, if there was anybody left, they might say, "Ah, yeah, well, this is just a random celestial event that was bound to happen sooner or later because of gravity and orbital mechanics and where this comet tends to go and be." But from the teleological perspective, people might go, "Well, yes, this clearly happened because, just like the scientist priests of Atlantis that were experimenting with very dangerous technology, they simultaneously invoked the wrath of the gods. And the gods maybe sent down some beams of lightning or did other kind of like actions that might have also been created by the actions of the scientist priest himself through their experiments." So this is all different ways of looking at exactly the same thing, but this is all in operation right now. So I think that we need to consider both the right and left hemisphere aspects of all this. We need to look at the scientific approach to understanding the reality of what it is that we're doing, but also look at it from the spiritual, purposive, teleological perspective, that there may be guardian beings or intelligences far greater than us who are monitoring everything and allowing us to take ourselves out to a certain degree But there may be a much more refined, intelligent process to it. It may be that we're taking out areas that have specific energies. I don't know. I can't see anything positive about a beautiful old growth redwood forest in California being incinerated by directed energy weapons that looks like the Big Basin Visitor Center was just leveled to ash, but there's trees right around it that still have leaves. And for people to attribute that to climate change is beyond insane. Anyway, I think next week's show I'm going to be probably talking about the geophysical warfare thing in greater detail. And hopefully this fire scenario is not going to be as bad as it was last year. And hopefully not at all here in Australia. But it's time for me to go and jump in the ocean and have my swim, my connection with water-based life, and the beautiful salt water that doesn't like electronics. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson signing off for On the Brink Radio here in Dripstone Beach on the coast of Darwin, Northern Territory. Live simply so that others may simply live. And Kia Manuia. Good day. Thank you.